Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to Season 2, Episode 22 of They Walk Among Us, a podcast dedicated to UK true crime. Listener caution is advised, as this episode contains adult themes and descriptions that some listeners may find distressing. Between 1975 and 1980, the Yorkshire Ripper used the north of England as a hunting ground. He spread fear, not just in Yorkshire, but across the entire country. The Yorkshire Ripper Peter Sutcliffe killed 13 women and attacked 8 others. But before his capture, police were duped by a recording and 3 letters sent by a hoaxer. The voice on the tape claimed that he was the serial killer. This false evidence would derail the investigation and divert attention away from the real culprit. Police would later discover the recordings were made by John Humble. For over a quarter of a century, the answer to the question who is Wearside Jack would remain unanswered, and John would lead detectives on a wild goose chase that may have cost 3 women their lives. John Samuel Humble was born on January 8, 1956. His mother Violet raised him after his father Samuel passed away when John was only 8 years old. He had a brother called Henry and a sister called Jean. They lived on the Hilton Lane estate in Sunderland. John attended both Hilton Road School and Havelock Secondary, receiving above average grades. After John had left school in Castletown, he found it difficult to forge a career path, trying his hand at cleaning windows, working as a security guard, and a labourer on a building site. In his spare time, he would be found in the Round Robin pub playing darts or watching football. He had an interest in crime writing and reading stories of Jack the Ripper, a notorious serial killer who stalked the streets of Whitechapel in the 1880s. John Humble also had a criminal record. In 1973, he received a conviction for burglary and theft, and 2 years on had another run-in with the law for assaulting an off-duty police constable in Sunderland's Locarno Ballroom. He had viciously kicked the man in the head and received 3 months in a Young Offenders Institute. During the time Peter Sutcliffe was terrorising the ridings of Yorkshire, John Humble began sending letters to Assistant Chief Constable George Oldfield, who was heading the Ripper investigation in March 1978. The letters contained detailed information relating to the attacks that hadn't been published, and police believed that they were written by the Yorkshire Ripper. It wasn't until many years later it was identified that information police believed to have been withheld had actually been disclosed to the press. The first letter, written by John and addressed to Assistant Chief Constable George Oldfield, was posted on March 8, 1978. describing himself as the Ripper and stating his purpose was to rid the streets of sex workers. The letter implied that he had killed 8 women, not 7 as initially thought. Part of the letter read, "Up to 8 now, you say 7, but remember Preston 75. This was a reference to the murder of Joan Harrison. Joan Harrison was a 26-year-old sex worker. She was last seen walking towards Preston Town Centre just before 10:30 p.m. Her body was found in a derelict garage on November 23, 1975. Joan had been sexually assaulted and mercilessly beaten. She died as a result. Items of her jewellery had been taken, including 2 wedding rings, and she had a deep bite mark on her left breast. Peter Sutcliffe denied that Joan was one of his victims, was never charged with her murder. It wasn't until decades later in 2011 that the truth would finally be revealed. Advances in forensic techniques improved the way DNA could be analysed, and this helped the Lancaster Police Force identify an individual they believed to be the culprit. A man named Christopher Smith from Leeds, West Yorkshire may have been involved, after DNA recovered from the crime scene matched his profile. Christopher Smith was only known by that name for the last 2 decades of his life. Born Alexander Smith, he was raised in Derry, Northern Ireland, and during his teenage years he moved to Wales before committing a number of petty thefts as he travelled between Bolton, Salford, Stoke-on-Trent and Leeds. He had over a dozen aliases and was imprisoned during 1981 for just under 3 years after being charged with the attempted rape of a 17-year-old in Manchester. Alexander Smith had been married 3 times and had a history of domestic abuse. He was given a suspended sentence for stabbing his first wife, and he threw his second wife out of a window when she was 7 months pregnant. Christopher had a DNA swab taken in 2008 after being arrested for drink driving, but died shortly after as he was suffering from lung cancer. On his deathbed, he scribbled a 2-page note which was found at his home. The note read, "To whoever it concerns, I would like to put the record straight. I can't go on with the guilt. I have lived with it for over 20 years. I'm truly sorry for all the pain I've caused to anyone. Please believe me when I say I'm sorry. I love my grandkids and my daughter. I cannot go back to prison anymore. Please God help my family who I worship. I've been out of trouble for over 20 years, so please God help me. I am so sorry. God forgive me. I love you all forever." The DNA result came as a shock to his family, as over the last 20 years he appeared to be a good father, grandfather, and a devout family man. The Crown Prosecution stated they had enough evidence to charge him if he had still been alive. During February 2011, Detective Chief Superintendent Graham Gardner, the head of crime for the Lancashire Constabulary, stated, "This has been a long-running and complex homicide inquiry for the Constabulary. Joan lost her life in a most brutal way, and despite the enormous efforts of all those originally involved, no charges were ever brought. Advances in DNA interpretation over the years has finally allowed us to identify Smith as the man at the scene of Joan's murder. That fact, coupled with other evidence we have gathered over the recent months, has been sufficient to convince the Crown Prosecution Service that Smith would have been charged with her murder had he been alive today. It is with some regret that Smith is not still alive to stand trial for his crime. One can only try to imagine the sadness endured by Joan's family over the years, and I truly hope this development will finally bring some closure surrounding their tragic loss." A week after Wearside Jack sent his first letter in March 1978, a second was sent to the chief editor at the Daily Mirror. The second letter, much like the first, was initially discounted by police, believing them to be hoaxes. However, upon receiving the third letter a year later, again addressed to George Oldfield and posted from Sunderland, this caught the attention of the police force, who started to treat the letters more seriously. The letters were similar in style to those written by Jack the Ripper from the 1880s. It was the spring of 1979, and during his early 20s, John Humble purchased a cassette tape from Woolworths, and using a tape machine that he had borrowed from his brother, John recorded a message claiming to be the Yorkshire Ripper. It was a cassette tape addressed to George Oldfield that would change the entire focus of the investigation. The hoax was incredibly costly for the police force. It diverted their resources from finding the actual killer. Received on June 17, 1979, the recording taunted the assistant chief constable.
"I'm Jack. I see you are still having no luck catching me. I have the greatest respect for you, George. But Lord, you are no nearer catching me now than 4 years ago when I started. I reckon your boys are letting you down, George. They can't be much good, can they? The only time they came near catching me was a few months back in Chapeltown when I was disturbed. I warned you in March that I'd strike again. Sorry it wasn't Bradford. I'm not quite sure when I'll strike again. But it will be definitely sometime this year. I'm not sure where. Maybe Manchester. I like it there. There's plenty of them knocking about. They never learn, do they, George? I bet you've warned them, but they never listen. Well, it's been nice chatting to you, George. Yours, Jack the Ripper."
The recording ended with "Thank You for Being a Friend" by Andrew Gold. The police focused their efforts on finding out who the man on the recording was, believing him to be the Ripper. The tape had been cleaned of fingerprints, and any identifying marks had been filed away. Custard powder was found on the cassette casing, suggesting it was probably recorded in a kitchen. The police were aware of Peter Sutcliffe. His name was mentioned 9 times in a police document summarising the Ripper suspects. As his accent and writing style didn't match the letters and the tape, he was discounted as a viable suspect. Based on the tape, language experts pinpointed Castletown, a small village in Sunderland, as the place the Ripper had grown up, so resources were diverted there, which was less than a mile away from John's home on the opposite side of the River Wear. Tracy Brown, who had survived an attack by the Ripper, heard the recording and insisted the voice on the tape didn't belong to her attacker. She had spoken to Peter Sutcliffe for 30 minutes and knew the difference between a Yorkshire and a Geordie accent. The police didn't initially believe that Tracy had been attacked by the Ripper, so the identikit picture that she provided was ignored. In 1979, John Humble called the police anonymously, declaring that the tape was a fake. Guilt was starting to eat him up, as the Ripper had killed another victim while the police diverted their attention away from the real culprit.
"Peter, I can't hear you, it's a bad line.
It's a tape.
What's a fake?
A tape recorder.
What one is this, the one that you just received?
The Ripper, the recorder.
How do you know that?
Just tell him.
Just tell him?
The one in June.
Pardon?
The one in June.
I'm sorry, it's a bad, it's a bad line, you're going to have to repeat it."
PC Keith Mount, who worked in the incident room, took the call and was convinced it was Wearside Jack, but after feeding this information back to his supervisors, it was sent to the Home Office laboratory, but they didn't believe the voice on the calls matched the tape. 2 months later, as John was struggling to come to terms with the impact of his actions, he attempted to take his own life. He was saved by 2 police officers after he jumped into the River Wear with his pockets full of stones. He spent several months in hospital after sustaining multiple injuries and also received psychiatric treatment to aid in his rehabilitation. He moved back to his childhood home where his brother and sister lived. As weeks turned to months and months turned to years, in 1990 John's life took a turn for the better after he met and married 40-year-old Anne Mason. Despite her family being barred from the wedding, for a time, the two were happy. Anne had 2 children from a previous relationship, and John seemed to be the ideal stepfather to her boy and girl. He worked on a construction site, earning a steady income to support his family. But sadly, things were not what they seemed. John had assaulted Anne a number of times. He lost his job, and tensions between them hit breaking point. John lashed out one final time before their relationship dissolved and the couple split up. Shortly after the breakup, John's mother passed away. Struggling to come to terms with his mother's death, John turned to alcohol, and his life continued on a downward spiral. He moved in with his brother, who had since relocated to the Ford estate. John tried his hand at window cleaning to make ends meet, but his drinking habit got the better of him. He earned the nickname John the Bag as he would often be seen sleeping rough in cemeteries and on park benches with a rucksack containing bottles of cheap cider. The press would later speak to John's neighbour Antoinette Steele, who said John was fine when he was younger. He loved to play darts in the local pub and worked really hard on the buildings, but it all changed once he left Anne. First thing in the morning when the shop opened, he and his brother would go down for a drink and he would be back there at tea time. Another neighbour, Leslie Carr, said, "I felt very sorry for them. They used to get in such a state with the drink. They were always getting picked on by kids around here who would even rifle their pockets in the street." Locals thought John harmless and inoffensive, but in 2001 he was arrested for being drunk and disorderly, and his DNA was entered into the National Police database. Over the next few years, the investigation into Wearside Jack went cold, and police resources were diverted elsewhere. Believing that modern-day testing may now be inaccurate due to the chemicals used on evidence in the 1970s, the case into Wearside Jack was shelved.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A break in the case came when in 2005, the West Yorkshire Homicide and Major Inquiry Team decided to go over the details of the case just once more, given the advances in DNA technology. While this sounded like a golden opportunity to find out who Wearside Jack really was, investigators were scuppered at the first hurdle as the whereabouts of the letters and tapes were unknown. The archives of the West Yorkshire Police Force were searched without much luck, and investigators approached the Forensic Science Services located in Wetherby, who were thought to have the letters and tapes, although at first this also turned up a blank. It wasn't until three sections of the gum seal from one of the letters were finally found that police now had an important piece of the puzzle. The seal was analysed as it was assumed to have been licked by the culprit, or at the very least it could lead detectives to a person that might know who Wearside Jack was. Forensic experts only had one opportunity to extract a profile, as the process would destroy the seal. The results were processed through the United Kingdom National DNA Database, which holds details of criminals convicted since 2001. A match was found, with there being a 1 in a billion chance that it could be anyone else. The match was John Samuel Humble from Sunderland, and he was arrested in October 2005. Police arrived at Henry Humble's property at Flodden Road on the Ford estate, where John had been staying after the breakup of his marriage. He would spend most days in a drunken stupor, and predictably, when police found him, he was inebriated. After being taken to Wakefield Police Station, he didn't fully understand the situation he found himself in. At first, he refused to speak during the interview, only shaking or nodding his head to each question posed. Investigators believed that John wasn't speaking, worried that the recording of his voice would be compared to the original recording received back in 1979. The following day, after a night's sleep, John admitted that he authored the letters and confirmed it was his voice on the tape. John told police he gathered the information from press clippings and books based on the original Ripper murders.
"This interview is being tape recorded and it may be given in evidence if this case goes to court. Could you give me, please, your full name and your date of birth?"
"I can tell you that this is John Samuel Humble. I am telling you who he is because Mr. Humble has indicated to me he is not going to say anything at this stage."
"Were you aware of the letters that were being sent, John, in relation to the Ripper inquiry?" Shaking your head. "Did you see the Yorkshire Ripper inquiry on television?" Shaking your head. "Have you sent these letters, John?" Shaking your head. "Tell me in detail, please. John, this is your opportunity to tell your version of events and your side of the story. What can you tell me about it, John?"
"I did send it."
"Just repeat that for me. What did you say?"
"I did send the letter."
"Tell me all about it, John."
"Later on, in June, I sent it to you. It's got my voice on. So I thought I was doing him a favour, letting the coppers look harder. And they did, they caught him."
"Where did you get Jack from?"
"Oh, I read a boot in the library."
"There are some significant similarities in the letters that you wrote. Did you use some of the phrases and some of the knowledge that you picked up from the book?"
"More than lately, from the books."
"From the book?"
"Yeah."
"You mentioned briefly yesterday that you may have taken some excerpts out of that book and transferred them onto the letters."
"Aye, well, I read it thoroughly, like."
"Right. Did you mark in the book any..."
"I just got fascinated by it, you know. I panicked when the coppers were raking all over the castle town where I live on the other side of the river."
"Did they knock on your door, John?"
"No, I didn't get anywhere near me."
"You were never seen throughout the inquiry when they spent all that time in Sunderland?"
"Not once."
"How old were you?"
"I couldn't believe it."
"Pardon?"
"I couldn't believe it."
"Why couldn't you believe it?"
"I didn't, because they were checking him. They checked the bloke next door, Ernie."
"What else did you put on the end of that tape?"
"Oh, there was like a little tune."
"What tune was that?"
"Thank you for being a friend."
As Peter Sutcliffe committed a murder in September 1979, it only added more credence to the authenticity of the letters. Some believed that Peter Sutcliffe might have read the letters and heard the tape, coinciding his next attack to divert police attention. Maybe true, maybe not, but either way, the hoax had a devastating effect on the investigation. After being interviewed, John Humble appeared before Leeds Crown Court to hear the charges against him, and a trial date was set for February 20th the following year. In a hearing that lasted less than 5 minutes, John, who stood between two heavy-set security guards, confirmed his name, date of birth, and home address. The clerk of the court read in the charges. She said, "You sent a series of communications, namely three letters and an audio tape, to West Yorkshire Police and the press, claiming to be the perpetrator of a series of murders that at the time were the subject of a police investigation." A plea was not entered, and John would remain in custody. Reporting restrictions were put in place so John Humble couldn't be identified by the national press. Less than a week later, he appeared before Leeds Crown Court via a video link from Armley Jail. In the preliminary hearing, David Taylor, acting on behalf of the defence, put forward an application for bail. However, this was rejected by the judge. At the start of the new year on January 9th, John appeared in Leeds Crown Court and initially pled not guilty to the charges of perverting the course of justice. David Taylor, John's barrister, stated to the court that he would be presenting evidence from handwriting and voice resonation experts to prove his client was not guilty. "Mr. Humble's case, as he has no recollection of writing the letters or sending the tape," the barrister said. Richard Hebbett, acting on behalf of the prosecution, explained that evidence to prove John's guilt would include blood, fingerprint, and DNA analysis. A new trial date was set for March 20th, 2006, and John would remain in police custody. During the morning of February 23rd, 2006, John Humble admitted that he wrote the letters and sent the tape to Detective George Oldfield, however denied the charges against him. Speaking at Leeds Crown Court before Judge James Stewart QC, David Taylor said, "A defence statement has been drafted whereby the defence concedes that he wrote the letters and in fact made the tape. The issue now is not one of whether it was actually him, it's solely the question of intent." John's defence barrister explained that John had been driven to alcohol due to the guilt he felt about what he had done, but he was trying to help the police focus their inquiries. John Humble denied he intended to pervert the course of justice, as he had made attempts to notify the police that the tape was a hoax during September 1979. The trial would still take place on March 20th, and press restrictions were lifted, so John Samuel Humble was identified as Wearside Jack. On the day of the trial, John Samuel Humble pled guilty to four counts of perverting the course of justice. Paul Worsley QC, acting on behalf of the prosecution, told the court that John was fascinated with tales of Jack the Ripper and based his letters upon the killer's writing style. By issuing the letters, John threw the investigation off course and deliberately obstructed the police in carrying out their duty. Paul Worsley said, "After the first two letters were sent, the hoaxer did not know whether the police were taking them seriously. But when it was revealed the police were taking them seriously, he could have stopped. He did not. He was to send another letter and then a tape. That made it clear he wanted to send the police off the trail of the true killer." He added, "It was a haunting and sinister recording. The tape was not recorded in haste. It was recorded deliberately, with no mistakes, from a script which must have been carefully researched. It had no label and bore no fingerprints, and the hoaxer knew the police could not ignore it. Who else other than the Yorkshire Ripper himself could conceivably want to throw the police off the scent of the Ripper? It either came from the Yorkshire Ripper or someone who had amassed an encyclopedic knowledge of the Ripper and his movements and attacks." Paul Worsley continued, "The hoaxer must have scoured the press very carefully to pick up such fine detail which was likely to mislead the police into thinking the letter was genuine. All of the things in the letters and the tapes were in the public domain, the Crown say, but the hoaxer must have gone to the trouble of acquiring an encyclopedic knowledge of the case in order to appear convincing." John explained that he attempted to notify police that the letters and tape was a hoax. I phoned in to tell them it was a hoax, but they didn't take any notice, he said. In reference to Barbara Leach, another of Peter Sutcliffe's victims who was murdered at the start of September 1979, John said, I blame myself for it. That's why I phoned in. They took no notice, and another two got killed. Shortly after Barbara Leach was murdered, John Humble attempted to take his own life. On March 21, 2006, John Humble was sentenced to 8 years in prison after admitting to 4 counts of perverting the course of justice. During mitigation, John's barrister, Simon Bourne-Arton QC, addressed the court and said John didn't realise the extent to which his communication would shape the investigation. He said he did not for one moment think the police would ultimately react to the extent they did. It was not until he was to hear his voice being broadcast over the television that he became so aware. Simon Bourne-Arton posed a question to the court. Who was to say the police would have captured Peter Sutcliffe sooner if that tape hadn't been sent to the police? The defence barrister asked for leniency, as John had struggled with alcohol dependency, and this may have clouded his judgment. Simon Bourne-Arton said, he is 50 years old at the time of his arrest, and at the time of his arrest he was a hopeless alcoholic. He was so drunk as to be incoherent, and police couldn't interview him for more than a day. The barrister added, had it not been for these matters that brought John Humble before your lordship yesterday, he would have led a spectacularly inadequate life. During sentencing, Judge Norman Jones addressed John Humble. He said, you arrogantly set out to send the investigation away from the path of the true killer. You did that with an indifference to the potentially fatal consequences which was breathtaking, and this sets you in the most serious category of offending of this type. The Ripper attacked without mercy, and police were baffled for 5 years, and he remained undetected. I'm satisfied one of the factors that may well have contributed to his remaining at large for so long was you sending the letters and the tape. While it cannot be said that your actions caused or directly led to the murders of 3 women and the attacks on 2 other women who survived, they move the focus of the police investigation to Sunderland. While it can neither be said with any certainty that the murderer might have been caught any earlier, we can be sure from statements made by Peter Sutcliffe on his arrest that the hoax letters and tape had given him confidence to continue on his course of actions. The least that could be said was these victims would have stood a better chance of not being attacked had these police resources been directed in West Yorkshire. You took on his persona. Your letters comprised a mixture of taunts and threats and were well researched. Then you sent a tape recording of you pretending to be the Ripper. It was cleverly constructed and your delivery was sinister. Police were persuaded that the hoaxer was the killer, and you must have appreciated the way police were being led astray. At no time did you have the courage to come forward and confess. You are a man with a dislike of the police, and it gave you pleasure to make fools of them. What is unforgivable is that you failed to put the record straight when you realised the damage you were doing. Had the tape not been sent, the deployment to Sunderland, whether wise or not, would simply not have occurred. Perverting the course of justice is a serious offence because the intention of the offender is to manipulate our justice system and produce injustice. In this case, the manner of your offending, if not unique, is almost so. You plan to manipulate the process of the investigation of one of the most horrific series of murders ever seen in this country. You warped and bent its path away from the true killer. For these reasons, I have elected to impose the most severe sentence available to me given the charges brought. I sentence John Samuel Humble to 8 years in prison for each of the 4 counts of perverting the course of justice, the sentences to run concurrently. So where are we now? In July 2006, John Humble was granted leave to appeal the length of his sentence. David Taylor, the defence counsel during the appeal, believed that the sentence was manifestly excessive and too severe. He thought his client was a different man from the one who committed the crimes 20 years ago, and more emphasis should have been put on his client's guilty plea. The appeal was rejected 3 months later in October. One of the three judges presiding on the appeal panel, Mr. Justice Calvert Smith, thought while the term was severe, it was not wrong in principle or excessive. He said the crime was uniquely serious and had possibly fatal consequences. David Taylor had told the judges that John Humble had been a chronic alcoholic for most of his adult life, drinking as soon as he woke up until the moment he passed out. He said that John had been a model prisoner since he had been in custody, and ironically, the fact he has been in custody probably saved his life. John Humble served half his sentence at a low-risk Category C prison in Yorkshire and was later released on licence, moving back to Wearside. His family have received numerous death threats, and John was assaulted after his release. John's sister Jean spoke to the Mirror newspaper and said he has moved on with his life. We all have, but nobody will forget what he did. Thank you for listening, and special thanks to our Patreon supporters. For more information, please visit theywalkamonguspodcast.com. To support They Walk Among Us and receive ad-free content and other extras, please head to patreon.com/theywalkamonguspodcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @TWAU_podcast or follow us on Instagram and Facebook under They Walk Among Us Podcast.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.